Around the corner, sitting in the light of one lantern, Colon nudged Vimes, wrinkled his nose and pointed down. There was a gully that ran between all the cells as a primitive sop to hygiene. Now a thin trickle was inching its way along it. Ferret was nervous. Gotcha, thought Vimes. But a good imagination needs a little more time. He leaned forward, and the other two moved closer expectantly. So, he said in a low whisper, have you boys had your holidays yet? After a few minutes of very small talk, he stood up, strode round to the last occupied cell, unlocked the door, and grabbed Ferret, who was trying to squeeze into a corner. No! Please, I'll tell you whatever you want to know, the man yelled. Really? Said Vimes. What's the orbital velocity of the moon? What? Oh, you'd like something simpler, said Vimes, dragging the man out of the cell. Fred, Waddy, he wants to talk. Bring a notebook. It took half an hour. Fred Colon wasn't a fast writer, and when the painful sound of his efforts concluded with the stab of his last full stop, Vimes said, OK, sir. And now you write down at the end, I, Gerald Leastways, currently staying at the Young Men's Pagan Association, am making this statement of my own free will and not under duress, and then you sign it or else. Got it? Yes, sir. The initials GL had been inscribed on the dagger. Vimes believed them. He'd met plenty of Leastwayses in his career, and they tended to spill their guts at the mere thought of spilling their guts. And when they did, you got everything. Anyone who'd seen the ginger beer trick used on someone else would confess to anything. Well, now, he said cheerfully, standing up. Thank you for your cooperation. Want a lift to Cable Street? Ferret's expression, if not his mouth, said, huh? We've got to drop off your friends, Vimes went on, raising his voice slightly. Todsey and Muffer. We'll drop the dead one off at the mortuary. Just a bit of paperwork for you. He nodded at Colon. One copy of your helpful statement, one certificate of death from the pox doctor for the late mystery man, and rest assured we'll try to track down his murderer. A chitty from Mossy about the ointment he put on Muffer's feet. Oh, and a receipt for 6 bottles of ginger beer. He put a hand on Ferret's shoulder and gently walked him round into the next cellar, where Todsey and Muffer were sitting gagged, bound, and livid with rage. On a table nearby was a box containing 6 flagons of ginger beer. The corks were heavily wired down. Ferret stared at Vimes, who inserted a finger in his mouth, blew up his cheeks, and flicked out the finger with a loud pop. Waddy hissed between his teeth. Fred Colon opened his mouth, but Vimes clamped his hand over it. No, don't, he said. Funny thing, Gerald, but Fred here just screams out loud at times for no reason at all. You tricked me, Ferret wailed. Vimes patted him on the shoulder. Tricked? He growled. How so, Gerald? You made me think you were doing a ginger beer trick. Ginger beer trick? Said Vimes, his brow wrinkling. What's that? You know. You brought the stuff down here. We don't drink alcohol on duty, Gerald, said Vimes severely. What's wrong with a little ginger beer? We don't know any tricks with the stuff, Gerald. What tricks do you know? Seen any good tricks lately, Gerald? Do tell. At last it dawned on Ferret that he should stop talking. It was about half an hour too late. The expressions on what could be seen of the faces of Todsey and Muffer suggested that they wanted a very personal word with him. I demand protective custody, he managed. Just when I'm letting you go, Gerald, said Vimes. As you said in your statement, what was it, Fred? Something about just obeying orders? All that stuff about mixing with the mobs and throwing things at coppers and soldiers? You didn't want to do that, I know. You didn't like being round in Cable Street watching people being beaten up and being told what to confess to, because it's plain to me that you're not that sort. You're small fry. I understand that. I say we'll call it quits. How about you? Please, I'll tell you all I know, Ferret squeaked. You mean you haven't? Vimes roared. He spun around and grabbed a bottle. Yes, no, I mean, if I sit quiet, I'm sure I'll remember some more. Vimes held his gaze for a moment and then dropped the bottle back in the crate. All right, he said. It'll be $1 a day, meals extra. Right you are, sir. Vimes watched Ferret scuttle back into his cell and shut the door behind him. Then he turned to Fred and Waddy. Go and wake up Marilyn, he said. Let's deliver the other 3. The rain was falling steadily and a thin mist filled Cable Street. The wagon came out of nowhere, Fred had urged Marilyn into something approaching a canter down the street, and when the horse came round the corner she was trying to keep ahead of the heavy, rumbling cart behind. As the hurry-up wagon passed the station, the rear door was flung open, and two bodies were tumbled out onto the wet cobbles. The guards rushed forward. One or two of them fired after the retreating cart, but the arrows clattered harmlessly off the black iron strips. The other men approached the tied-up bodies with some care. There were groans, punctuated by swear words, and, pinned to one man, some paperwork. They read the note. They did not laugh. Vimes unharnessed the old horse, rubbed her down, and checked on her feed. Perhaps it was his imagination, but the feed bin seemed fuller than 2 days ago. Guilty consciences were at work, maybe. Then he walked out into the cool night air. The lights were on in the watch-house. It was a beacon, now that the street lamps had been doused. Beyond the walls of the yard, the real night had closed in, the old night with its tendrils of fog and crawling shadows. He relaxed and wore it like an overcoat. A shadow near the gate was deeper than it ought to be. He felt for his cigar case again, cursed, and pulled a cigar out of his shirt sleeve. He cupped his hands when he lit it, but kept his eyes tightly shut to hold the night vision. Then he looked up and blew a smoke ring. Yes. Everyone thought black didn't show up at night. They were wrong. He walked over to shut the gate and then pulled out his sword in one fluid movement. Sadie raised her head, revealing a pale oval of a face in the depths of her bonnet.
"Good morning, kind sir," she said.
"Good morning, Sadie," said Vimes wearily. "To what do I owe this pleasure?"
"Madam wants to see you, kind sir."
"If you mean Rosie, I've been a bit busy." Dotsy's handbag hit him on the back of the head.
"Madam doesn't like waiting, dearie,"
were the last words he heard before night closed in all the way. The aunts were experts. Probably not even Mossy Lawn could turn someone off with such precision. Vimes drifted awake. He was in an armchair. It was extremely comfortable, and someone was shaking him. It was Sandra, the real seamstress. She stared at him and said,
"He looks okay."
Then she stepped back, sat down in another chair, and aimed a crossbow at him.
"You know," said Vimes.
It really was a comfortable chair and reminded him of the softness that had gone from his life in the past few days. It hadn't all been bad.
"If someone wants to talk to me, they only have to bloody well ask."
"Sadie said you'd only be out for 10 minutes, but then you started to snore, so we thought we'd let you sleep for a while," said Rosie Palm, stepping into view. She was wearing a red off-the-shoulder evening dress, an impressively large wig, and quite a lot of jewellery. "Yeah, it costs a lot of money to look as cheap as this, Sergeant," she said, catching his expression. "I can't stop. I must go and talk to people. Now, if you..."
"Snapcase has promised you ladies that you'll be allowed to form a guild, right?" said Vimes.
It was another cheating move, but he was fed up with waking up in odd places.
"Yes, I thought so. And you believe him? It's not going to happen. When he's the patrician, he'll look right through you."
"He'll end up looking through everything," he added to himself. "Mad Lord Snapcase. Just another window, but with fancier waistcoats and more chins. Same cronyism, same piggy ways, same stupid arrogance. One more leech in a line of leeches that'd make veterinary seem like a breath of clean air." Veterinary, yes. He'd be around here somewhere too, no doubt, learning that little expression he had which never, ever gave you a clue what he was thinking. But he'll be the one to give you the guild you want so much.
"Don't expect anything from Snapcase," he said aloud. "Remember, there were people who thought Winder was the future, too."
He derived some minor pleasure from seeing the look on Rosie Palm's face. At last she said, "Give him a drink, Sandra. If he moves, shoot an eye out. I'll let Madam know."
"Do you expect me to believe that she'll fire that?" said Vimes.
"Sandra has a very useful streak of belligerence," said Rosie. "A gentleman was being impolite yesterday, and she came running in, and you'll be surprised at what she did with her mushroom." Vimes eyed the crossbow. The girl had a very steady hand.
"I don't think I quite under—" he began.
"It's a wooden thing to make it easier to darn socks," said Sandra. "I hit him behind the ear with it."
Vimes gave her a blank look for a while and then said,
"Fine, fine. I'm sitting very still, believe me."
"Good," said Rosie. She swept out, and it was a real sweep, the dress brushing the ground. There were big, expensive double doors, When she opened them, the noise of a meeting filled the room. There was conversation, the smell of cigar smoke and alcohol, and a voice said, "To change the dominant episteme," before the doors breathed shut. Vimes stayed seated. He was getting attached to the chair, and on current showing, someone was likely to hit him again soon. Sandra, still holding the bow, placed a very large glass of whiskey beside him.
"You know," he said, "in times to come, people will wonder how all those weapons got smuggled round the city."
"I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about."
"And it's because the lads in the watch never bother about the seamstresses, curfew or no curfew," said Vimes, staring at the whiskey. "Or posh coaches," he added. "A watchman can get into real trouble if he tries that."
He could smell the stuff from here. It was the good stuff from the mountains, not the local rubbish.
"You didn't tell anyone about the basket," said Sandra, "or hand us over to the unmentionables. Are you one of us?"
"I doubt it."
"But you don't know who we are."
"I still doubt it."
And then he was aware of the doors opening and shutting, and the rustle of a long dress.
"Sergeant Keel, I've heard so much about you. Please leave us, Sandra. I'm sure the good sergeant can be trusted with her lady."
Madam was only a little shorter than Vimes. Could be from Genoa, he thought, or spent a lot of time there. Trace of it in the accent. Brown eyes, brown hair. But a woman's hair could be any colour tomorrow. And a purple dress that looked more expensive than most. And an expression that said quite clearly that the owner knew what was going to happen and was going along with things just to make sure.
"Don't forget the intricately painted fingernails," she said. "But if you're trying to guess my weight, don't expect to get any help from me. You can call me Madam."
She sat down in a chair opposite him, put her hands together and stared at him over the top of them.
"Who are you working for?" she said.
"I'm an officer of the City Watch," said Vimes. "Brought here under duress, Madam."
The woman waved a hand.
"You're free to go whenever you wish."
"It's a comfy chair," said Vimes.
He was damned if he'd be dismissed.
"Are you really from Genoa? Are you really from Pseudopolis?"
Madam smiled at him.
"I find personally that it pays never to be from somewhere close at hand. It makes life so much easier. But I have spent a lot of time in Genoa, where I have business interests."
She smiled at him.
"And now you're thinking old seamstress, no doubt."
"Actually, I was thinking bespoke tailoring," said Vimes, and she burst out laughing.
"But mostly," he added,
"I was thinking revolutionary."
"Continue, Sergeant."
Madam stood up.
"Do you mind if I have some champagne? I'd offer you some, but I understand that you don't drink."
Vimes glanced at the brimming whiskey glass beside him.
"We were just checking,"
said Madam, hauling a large bottle out of an industrial capacity ice bucket.
"You're not a sergeant. Rosie was right. You've been an officer. More than just any old officer, too. You're so composed, Sergeant Keel. Here you are, in a big house, in a lady's boudoir, with a woman of uneasy virtue."
Madam upended the bottle into what appeared to be a blue mug with a teddy bear on it.
"And you appear unfussed. Where are you from? You may smoke, by the way."
"Somewhere a long way off," said Vimes.
"Oberwald?"
"No."
"I have business interests in Oberwald," said Madam. "Alas, the situation there is becoming quite unstable."
"Right, I see," said Vimes. "And you'd like to have the significant pause type of business interests in Ankh-Morpork, I expect, if it can be stabilised."
"Very good. Let us say that I think this city has a wonderful future, and that I would like to be part of it, and that you are remarkably perspicacious."
"No," said Vimes. "I'm very simple. I just know how things work. I just follow the money. Winder is a madman, and that's not good for business. His cronies are criminals, but that's not good for business. A new patrician will need new friends, far-sighted people who want to be part of a wonderful future, one that's good for business. That's how it goes. Meetings in rooms, a little diplomacy, a little give and take, a promise here, an understanding there. That's how real revolutions happen. All that stuff in the streets is just froth."
Vimes nodded to the door.
"Guests for a late supper?" That was Dr. Follett's voice. "A clever man, they used to... they call him.
He'll pick the right side. If you've got the big gills with you, Winder is a dead man walking. But Snapcase won't do you much good."
"Many people have great hopes of him."
"What do you think?"
"I think he's a scheming, self-serving fool. But he's the best there is at the moment." "And where do you come in, Sergeant?"
"Me?
I'm staying outside. You've got nothing that I want.
You don't want anything?
I want lots of things, my lady, but you can't give them to me.
How would you like to be back in command?
The question hit him like a hammer. This was history. She couldn't know. How could she know?
Ah, said Madame, who had watched his expression. Rosemary did say thieves took some very expensive armour off you. Fit for a general, I hear.
She glanced at Vimes as she opened another bottle. Properly, too, Vimes noticed, through the shock. None of that amateur business with rocketing corks and wasted bubbles.
Wouldn't that be strange if it was true, Madame mused. A street-fighting man with the manner of a commander and the breastplate of a leader.
Vimes stared straight ahead.
And who needs to know how he got here? Said Madame to the air in general. We could take the view that here at last is a man who could truly take command of the city watch.
The first thought that fizzed in Vimes's head like champagne was, bloody hell, I could do it. Chuck swing out on his arse, promote some decent sergeants. The second thought was, in this city, and a snap case, now, we'd be just another gang. The third thought was, this is insane, it can't happen, it never did happen, you want to go home to Sybil. Thoughts one and two shuffled out of the way, feeling ashamed of themselves and mumbling, yeah, right, Sybil, yeah, obviously, yeah, right, sorry, until they faded into silence.
I've always had a talent for seeing promise, said Madame,
while he still stared at nothing. The fourth thought rose in the darkness like some ugly creature from the abyss.
You didn't think about Sybil until thought three, it whispered.
He blinked.
You know the city needs, Madame began.
I want to go home, said Vimes. I'm going to finish the job that's in front of me, and then I'm going home. That's what I'm going to do.
There are those that would say that if you are not for us, you're against us, said Madame.
For you? For what?
For anything? No. But I'm not for Winder either. I'm not supposed to be for people, and I don't take bribes, not even if Sandra threatens me with a toadstool.
I believe it was a mushroom.
Oh, dear.
The lady gave him a smile.
You are incorruptible.
Oh, dear, here we go again, thought Vimes. Why did I wait until I was married to become strangely attractive to powerful women? Why didn't it happen to me when I was 16? I could have done with it then. He tried to glare, but that probably only made it worse.
I've met a few incorruptible men, said Madame Mézerolle. They tend to die horrible deaths. The world balances out, you see. A corrupt man in a good world, or a good man in a corrupt one. The equation comes out the same way. The world does not deal well with those who don't pick a side.
I like the middle, said Vimes.
That gives you two enemies. I'm amazed that you can afford so many on a sergeant's pay. Please think of what you could be giving up.
I am, but I'm not going to help people to die just to replace one fool with another.
Then there is your door behind you, Sergeant. I am very sorry we could not do business, said Vimes. I was going to say, reach a mutually beneficial agreement. We are not very far from your watch house. I wish you luck.
She nodded towards the door.
Such a shame, she said, and sighed.
Vimes stepped out into the rainy night and shifted his weight from foot to foot, and then took a few experimental steps. Corner of Easy and Treacle Mine, a mix of flat-top cobbles and old bricks. Yeah. He went home. Madame stared at the closed door for a while and then turned as the candles flickered slightly.
You really are very good, she said. How long have you been here?
Havelock Vetinari stepped out of the shadow in the corner. He wasn't wearing official assassin's black, but loose clothes that were no real colour at all, just nondescript shades of grey. I've been here quite long enough, he said, sprawling into the chair that Vimes had vacated.
Not even the aunts noticed you.
People look, but don't see. The trick is to help them see nothing. But I think Vimes would have seen me if I hadn't been over here. He stares into shadows. Interesting.
He is a very angry man, said Madame.
You just made him angrier.
I believe you'll get your diversion, said Madame.
Yes, I believe so too. Madame leaned over and patted him on the knee.
There, she said. Your auntie thinks of everything.
She stood up.
I'd better go and entertain my guests. I am a very entertaining person. By tomorrow night, Lord Winder will not have many friends.
She drained her mug of champagne.
Dr. Follett is such a charming man, don't you think? Is that his own hair, do you know?
I have not sought the opportunity to find out, said Havelock. Is he trying to get you drunk?
Yes, said Madame. You have to admire him.
They say he can play a mean lute, said Havelock.
Fascinating, said Madame.
She set her face into a genuine smile of pleasure and opened the big double doors at the other end of the room.
Ah, doctor, she said, stepping into the haze of smoke, a little more champagne.
Vimes slept in the corner, standing up. It was an old trick shared by night watchmen and horses. It wasn't exactly sleep. You'd die if you tried to keep it up for more than a few nights, but it took some of the tiredness away. A few of the other men had already mastered the trick. Others made use of tables or benches. No one seemed inclined to go home, even when a sort of dawn suffused the rain and Snouty came in with a cauldron of fearsome porridge. Vimes opened his eyes.
"Mug of tea, Sarge," said Snouty. "Stewed for an hour and two sugars."
"You're a lifesaver, Snouty," said Vimes, clasping it like the elixir of life.
"And there's some kid outside who says he's got to speak to you."
"Specially," Snouty went on. "Shall I give him a clip alongside the head?"
"What does he smell like?" said Vimes, sipping the scalding, corrosive tea. "Bottom of a baboon's cage, Sarge."
"Ah, Nobby Nobs. I'll go out and see him. Bring him a big bowl of porridge, will you?" Snouty looked uncomfortable about this.
"If you'll take my advice, Sarge, it don't pay to encourage kids like—"
"See these stripes, Snouty? Well done. A big bowl." Vimes took his tea out into the damp yard, where Nobby was lurking against a wall. There were hints that it was going to be a sunny day. That should bring things on after the overnight rain. The lilacs, for example.
"What's happening, Nobby?"
Nobby waited a moment to see if a coin was forthcoming.
"Pretty bad everywhere, Sarge,"
he said, giving up for now but remaining hopeful.
"A constable got killed in Lobbied Clout, hit by a stone, people say. Someone got their ear cut off because of the fighting in Knapp Hill. Cavalry charge, Sarge. Running fights everywhere. All the watchhouses got hit bad."
Vimes listened gloomily to the list. It was the usual bloody business. Angry, frightened people on both sides, all crushed up together. It could only get worse. Knapp Hill and Dolly Sisters sounded like war zones already.
"See the little angels rise up high."
"Anything happening in Cable Street?" he said.
"Just a few people," said Nobby. "A bit of shouting and running away, that sort of thing."
"Right," said Vimes. Even a mob wasn't that stupid. It was still only the kids and the hotheads and the drunks now. It'd get worse. You'd have to be really mad to attack the unmentionables.
"There's bad stuff happening everywhere," said Nobby. "Except here, of course. We're well out of it."
No, thought Vimes. It'll pivot on us in the end. Snouty emerged from the watchhouse's rear door, carrying a big bowl of porridge with a spoon stuck in it. Vimes nodded towards Nobby, and the bowl was handed over with extreme reluctance.
"Sarge," said Snouty, keeping his eye on the spoon as the boy ate, or more correctly, gobbled the stuff.
"Yes, Snouty?"
"Have we got any orders?"
"I don't know. Is the captain here?"
"That's it, Sarge," said Snouty.
"A runner came last night with an envelope for the captain, and I took it up, and there was the captain waiting, so I thought, this is funny, ha ha, and I thought, but he's not normally in this early."
"Faster, please, Snouty," said Vimes, as the man started to watch the oscillating spoon again.
"Well, when I took him up his cocoa later on, he was just sitting there, staring right at nothing, and he said, 'Thank you, Snouty,' when I give him the cocoa." "No, I'm always very polite in that respect. But when I went up just now, he was gone."
"He's an old man, Snouty. You can't expect him to be here all—"
"So's his uncle, Sarge. He never took it home before."
And Vimes saw that Snouty's eyes were more red-rimmed than usual. He sighed.
"Any sign of the envelope?"
"No, Sarge," said Snouty, glancing again at the spoon in Nobby's hand.
It was a very cheap one, Vimes noted, made of some pot metal.
"In that case, we just keep the peace, Snouty," he said.
"Not a lot of that about, Sarge."
"We'll have to see what we can find. Come with me."
Snouty looked reluctant.
"Just want to keep an eye on the spoon, Sarge. We've only got five left, and kids like that one will pinch the—"
"He can keep that damn spoon," said Vimes. "Spoons are not important at this point."
Nobby downed the last scalding mouthful, stuck the spoon in his pocket, stuck out a porridge-laden tongue at Snouty, dropped the bowl on the ground, and took to his heels. Vimes strode back into the office, picked up the porridge ladle, and rattled it on the sides of the empty cauldron. Heads looked up.
"All right, my sons, this is what we're going to do. All married men have got permission to nip home for an hour to stop your wives fretting. The rest of you, you're on unpaid overtime. Anyone surprised?"
Wiglet raised a hand.
"We've all got family, Sarge," he said. "And the best thing you can do for them is make sure there's a bit of law around the place," said Vimes. "We don't know what's been happening in the other divisions, except that it sounds bad. So this house is staying open, understand? Day and night. Yes, Lance Constable."
"I mun be worrying, Sarge," said young Sam.
Vimes hesitated, but only for a moment.
"Snouty'll nip out with any messages you have, lad. The same goes for everyone else," he said. "We're going to go out and patrol soon. Yeah, I know we're night watch, so what? It's looking pretty black to me at the moment. Lance Constable, come out into the yard, will you?"
Vimes walked back out into the morning. In theory, one of the purposes of the yard was for training. It was seldom used for that. The night watch eschewed violence, as a rule. When threats or superior numbers had no effect, they preferred to run. There were some mouldering targets in the shed, along with some straw men for stabbing practice. Vimes tugged them out onto the cobbles as the Lance Constable appeared behind him.
"I thought you said these things were useless, Sarge."
"They are," said Vimes. "I've put them here for you to land on. You're walking around, Sam, with a weapon you don't know how to use. That's worse than walking around knowing how to use a weapon and not having one. A man with a weapon he doesn't know how to use is likely to have it shoved where the sun does not shine."
He took off his breastplate and helmet and tossed his sword belt into a corner.
"All right, attack me," he said.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw that some of the men had wandered into the yard and were watching.
"I can't just stab you, Sarge," Sam wailed.
"No, but I'd like you to try."
Sam hesitated again. "I wasn't entirely stupid," Vimes thought.
"You're grinning, Sarge," said Sam.
"Well?"
"You're just grinning and standing there, Sarge," said Sam. "I know I'm going to get a hiding, because you haven't got a sword and you're grinning."
"Worried about getting blood on your nice sword, lad? All right, throw it away. Feel better? You were in a gang, right? Of course you were. Everyone was. You're still alive, so you must have learned how to fight."
"Yeah, Sarge, but that was, you know, dirty fighting."
"We're dirty people. Do your worst," said Vimes.
"I don't want to hurt you, Sarge."
"That's your first mistake."
Sam spun and lashed out. Vimes stepped back, caught the foot and helped it on its journey upwards. "I was quick too," he thought, as Sam landed flat on his back. "And not too bad at cunning, but I've learned artful since then."
"It showed in your eyes," he said to the sprawling Sam. "But you've got hold of the basic idea. There's no rules."
He sensed the change behind him. It included the very muffled sound of a chuckle. He glanced back at Sam, who was looking past him. The blow was a neat one, to the back of where the head would have been if Vimes hadn't stepped smartly sideways. As it was, he turned and grabbed the arm and looked into the face of Ned Coates.
"Nice day off, Ned," he said.
"Yes, Sarge, thank you. Just wanted to see how good you were."
He elbowed Vimes in the stomach and twisted away. There was some murmuring from the watchers, but Vimes, bent double and with tears running from his eyes, raised a hand.
"No, that's fair enough," he panted. "We've all got something to learn."
He put his hands on his knees, wheezing a little more theatrically than he needed to. He was impressed that Ned wasn't falling for it. The man kept his distance, circling slowly. He was holding his truncheon. A less experienced fighter would have come to check that old Sarge was all right, and would have suffered for it.
"That's right, Sarge," said Ned. "I want to see what you can teach me. Sam's too trusting."
Vimes's mind riffled desperately through options.
"So, Sarge," said Ned, still moving, "what would you do, Sarge, if you were unarmed and a man came at you with a truncheon?"
"Get armed quick," thought Vimes, "if I thought he was as good as you." He ducked and rolled. Ned missed that. When Vimes started to move right, he'd concentrated on the left, on the basis that from someone like Vimes, the first move would have to be a feint. By the time he caught himself and turned, Vimes had grabbed his scabbard and was rising, sword sliding out.
"Ah, raising the stakes. Good lesson, Sarge," said Ned.
He drew his own sword. It gleamed. Most of the watch swords would have had difficulty cutting butter.
"Now we're level again. What next, Sarge?"
They circled. Blimey, thought Vimes, you taught him. And he's grinning, and no wonder. This isn't a contest. He knows I can't cut him, not like this, not in front of everyone. He can accidentally get me and get away with it. But a sergeant's supposed to know better. And we can't raise the stakes any higher. Hold on. He hurled the sword at the wall. It stuck in by sheer luck. That impressed the watchers.
"Got to give you a chance, Ned," he said, moving away.
"You can always learn," Vimes thought. He remembered Gussie Two Grins. Sam wouldn't run into him for 5 years or so. It would be a real education. Two Grins was the dirtiest fighter Vimes had ever met. Anything was a weapon. Anything was a target. Two Grins was a kind of genius in that limited area. He could see the weapon in anything, a wall, a cloth, a piece of fruit. He wasn't even a big man. He was small and wiry. But he liked fighting big men on the basis that there was more of them to bite. After a few drinks, though, it was hard to know what Two Grins was fighting. He'd fight the man next to him simply as a substitute for kneeing the whole universe in the groin. He'd been called Two Grins ever since someone glassed him in the face. Gussie had been so marinated in adrenaline at that point that he regarded this as a mere detail. The scar had left a happy, smiley face. Sam had learned a lot from Gussie Two Grins. "What's this about?" he murmured, just loud enough for Ned to hear. "Just want to find out what you know, Sarge," said Ned, still circling. "Seems to me you know too much." He lunged. Vimes darted back, flailed with the scabbard like a man with no hope, and as Ned laughed and leaned out of his way, shifted his grip on the stiff leather. "I've got the helmet on, as per regulations," said Ned. "And the armour. Hard to punch me out, Sarge." Even with detritus yelling at them, not one watchman in seven really used a sword properly. Ned did. There weren't many openings. Oh, well, time for artful. He took a step back, stopped, and saw what was happening behind Coates. He tried to hide it, but he couldn't stop the momentary flash of relief in his eyes. Coates couldn't stop the momentary flicker of attention. Vimes punched up, the scabbard an extension of his arm. The stiff leather caught the man under the chin, thrusting his head back. Then the leather was brought down on the sword hand, and, as an afterthought, Vimes kicked Ned on the shin just enough to make him collapse. He'd always had an allergy to edged weapons too near his face. "Well done! Nice try," he said, and turned his back and faced the crowd. To the sound of gurgling behind him, he said, "Anything's a weapon used right. Your bell is a club. Anything that pokes the other man hard enough to give you more time is a good thing. Never, ever threaten anyone with your sword unless you really mean it, because if he calls your bluff, you suddenly don't have many choices, and they're all the wrong ones. Don't be frightened to use what you learned when you were kids. We don't get marks for playing fair, and for close-up fighting, as your senior sergeant, I explicitly forbid you to investigate the range of coshies, blackjacks, and brass knuckles sold by Mrs. Goodbody at No. 8 Easy Street, at a range of prices and sizes to suit all pockets, and should any of you approach me privately, I absolutely will not demonstrate a variety of specialist blows suitable for these useful yet tricky instruments. Right, let's limber up. I want you all out here with your truncheons in 2 minutes. You think it's just a silly club? I will show you otherwise. Jump to it." He turned to the stricken Ned, who'd raised himself to a sitting position. "Nice moves, Mr. Coates. You didn't learn them in the watch, I know that. Anything we need to discuss? Care to tell me where you were last night? Morphic Street, maybe?" "Day off," muttered Ned, rubbing his jaw. "Right, right. None of my business. Seems to me we failed to hit it off, Ned." "That's right. You think I'm some kind of spy? I know you're not John Keel." Vimes kept his face perfectly impassive, which was, he realised, a complete giveaway in itself. "Why do you say that?" he said. "I don't have to tell you. You ain't a watch sergeant either, and you were lucky just now, and that's all I'm saying." Ned got to his feet as the other watchman filed out into the yard again. Vimes let him go and turned his attention to the men. None of them had ever been taught anything. They'd learned, to a greater or usually a lesser extent, from one another. And Vimes knew where that road went. On that road, coppers rolled drunks for their small change and assured one another that bribes were just perks, and it got worse. He was all for getting recruits out on the street, but you had to train them first. You needed someone like detritus bellowing at them for 6 weeks, and lectures about duty and prisoners' rights and the service to the public. And then you could hand them over to the street monsters who told them all the other stuff, like how to hit someone where it wouldn't leave a mark, and when it was a good idea to stick a metal soup plate down the front of your trousers before attending to a bar brawl. And if you were lucky, and they were sensible, they found somewhere between impossible perfection and the pit where they could be real coppers. Slightly tarnished, because the job did that to you, but not rotten. He formed them into twos and set them attacking and defending. It was dreadful to watch. He let it go on for 5 minutes. All right," he said, clapping his hands. "Very good indeed. When the circus comes to town, I'll definitely recommend you." The men sagged and grinned sheepishly as he went on. "Don't you know any of the moves? The throat slam? The red hot poker? The rib rattler?
Say I'm coming at you with a big, big club. What would you do?
Run away, Sarge, said Wiglet. There was laughter.
How far can you run? Said Vimes. Got to fight sometime.
Lance Corporal Coates.
Ned Coates had not been taking part. He'd been leaning against the wall in a sort of stationary swagger, watching the sad show with disdain.
Sarge,
he said, propelling himself upright, with the minimum of effort.
Show Wiglet how it's done.